the rest of you, if you would be so kind, if you'd be willing to stand with me as God's people stood at the foot of a mountain, so too we stand, just to recognize that this is one of the primary places where we encounter God together in His Word by the power of His Spirit. It's not the only place, but it is one of the primary places, or as one Mr. Planning guy used to say, one of the target areas of God's grace. And so that's why we stand, just to recognize that together. Starting in verse 1 together, and we're going to read all the way till we get to verse 8. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple courts and proclaiming the gospel, that is the good news, the chief priests and the teachers of the law together with the elders came up to him. "Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things?" they said. Who gave you this authority again?" And he replies, "Let me ask you a question. Tell me, John's baptism," meaning John the Baptist, his baptism, "was that from God or was it of human origin?" And so then they discussed amongst themselves and they said, "Hey, if we say from God, then he's going to say, why didn't we listen to John?" Right? Why didn't you believe him? "But if we say from human origins, then all these people here are going to stone us. They're going to murder us because they are persuaded that John is a prophet." So this is how they answered Jesus. "Yeah, we don't know. We don't know where it was from." And Jesus says, "Well, neither then am I going to tell you by what authority I am doing these things." These are the human, yet nonetheless inspired words of God. You may be seated. We've been talking a lot about this tension that we live with as Christians in terms of how we are to live in this world, in the world, but not of it. I like the rendition of being for this place, seeking the well-being of this place, and yet strange in all the good, in all the right ways, different, right? Because I think there is a way, again, of being in this world as Christians and not caring what happens to it. So we're in the world, but we're just buying our time, waiting for that Jesus to return. We're in the world, but we're just kind of waiting for heaven someday. And, you know, I got my trusty gospel. But I like that rendition of being for this place and yet somehow strange in all of the right places. Which then, you know, begs a question, and that is, well, what exactly is our interaction to be with culture? How are we to interact? What is our posture with this place? Are we sort of to just seek the good and everything as we go about our lives? Perhaps we are to seek or understand that which doesn't fit our biblical worldview and reject all of those things and just kind of hide our head in the sand and just kind of wait. Or are we to seek the good in certain things and find that which doesn't match our biblical values in other things? But before I kind of unpack that a little more, let me just suggest that a Christian approach to the world and interaction with the world is unusually open. I think Christians are to be unusually open with our world and culture. And let me also add, Christians are to be unusually closed. Now let me just tackle that or unpack the unusually closed portion. And the unusually closed portion comes from where we get our measure. Where do we get our measure for what is good, true, and beautiful? And where do we get our measure for that which isn't, that which is sinful and filled with brokenness? We get that measure not from here. We get that measure from outside of us. We get that measure from, first and foremost, God's character and that character as it is revealed in Jesus. So, on one hand, we could say that's not negotiable. On one hand, we can say that's not, you can't compromise on that. Now, how we apply, right, God's commands in each and every aspect of our lives, that's been up for human discussion for centuries as Christians, as you probably know. So on the one hand, we have an unusually closed posture towards the world. Yes, even in today's ethical climate. And yet, that closeness is precisely why we can be so open. That closeness is why we can be so open with the world and our culture. Because once the measure is not us, once the measure is not this place, once the measure is God, His character, His world, once the measure for what is sin and evil is not us, and He gives us that measure, then we can understand, or at least I think we should understand, that everything in this culture isn't perfectly good all the way down. everything in this world, and I don't care what we're talking about, right? Every sort of cultural phenomenon that you can think of, I mean, whether we're talking about a book, a novel, a film, a play, maybe we're talking more like cultural institutions, we could be talking about a Christian school, we could be talking about a non-Christian school, we could be talking about political ideology, a political party, we could be talking about any of these things, cultural phenomenon. There's none of these in this world. There's not one that you can name, including you and me, that's good all the way down, all the way through, or purely good. Nothing in culture is this way. And the implications for that are pretty massive. And one of the implications for that is that we can't affirm everything 100% all the time. The other implication for that is we cannot just condemn everything 100% with kind of unlimited condemnation. Wherever we look in culture, including in ourselves, we're going to find seeds of the fall. Wherever we look in culture, we're going to find seeds of rebellion against God in some form. Yet, in the same way, not everything in culture is so fallen, so completely and utterly broken and ugly that it can fully erase God's original intent or even, you know, purpose. And so we could say there's a fundamental haziness to the Christian life. There's a fundamental human complexity, right? Paul likes to use that language of seeing through the glass dimly in this way. Except, of course, for extreme cases of absolute evil, and I'll let the philosophers in this room discuss whether or not image bearers can actually achieve absolute evil here on earth. But we shouldn't see anything, including ourselves, as purely good, including Christian culture, or purely evil. Since human nature, yes, even Christians are a mixture of both the fall and ultimately God's original intent. By contrast, if this is all we have, right, say there is no measure, right? There is no God, there is no God who's revealed himself in his word. And if you still want to have working morals and you want to have useful ethics, which are, by the way, necessary if you're going to have any kind of social cohesion, and if you are going to want a justice system, right? So let's say there is no measure outside of us, and we have to find that here. We're going to have to either take two paths. Either we're going to find it in the struggle against like the oppressed, against the oppressor. We're going to have to find it in the struggle between like the free market and regulation. We're going to have to find it in perhaps our intellect or our rationality. So the concept there being, the more knowledge we have, the better we become as humans. And if that's your belief, I just highly recommend you read early 20th century history as scientific discoveries continue to progress in World War I, World War II, all of that. But essentially, we're going to have to find it somehow here in a kind of absolutist kind of way. Or we're going to have to do the opposite. We're going to have to just admit there isn't a measure. And whatever society is the strongest or whoever has the most influence and power gets to decide what that measure is. And both of these lead, right? One leads to the absolutist, can't be questioned kind of perspective. And the other option leads to cultural relativism in some form. A more biblical place to start, a more Christian way, combines, I think, the best of both worlds. As Jesus himself says, no one is good except God alone is good. Meaning, there is indeed a measure. It's just not you, it's just not me, it's nothing that we're going to find, it's not Christian culture, that's not the measure. This also means, I think, that the Christian position concerning our world can be very open to discerning how we best interact with it. Once we know that nothing is purely good all the way down, right, there's a lot of openness and play within how we get to best interact with culture, because nothing is utterly evil all the way down, and nothing is exhaustively good all the way through. In fact, our Christian view of the world, I think, makes us, or at least makes cultural engagement more engaging, not less. I actually think a Christian view of things, a biblical worldview, should make a Christian more hopeful about this place, not less hopeful about this place. Because where is our confidence? Where is it rooted? It's not rooted in us. It's rooted in someone outside of us. First and foremost, it's rooted in his unfolding story, which includes you and me. One advantage to, I think, the Christian worldview is complete intellectual freedom. Utterly complete in all areas of life. The pursuit of intellectual freedom with a full assurance that everything in this world belongs to who, Harriet? Who does everything in this world belong to? Yeah. God, right. So we have that, right? In our intellectual of, did I get that wrong again? Was it Harriet or Fiona first? It was Harriet? Maybe? All right. All right. But knowing this, right? Knowing that everything belongs to God gives us this openness because he's made everything intelligible. For example, once you know this truth that John says, through him all things were made, without him nothing was made that has been made. That should make us more curious, not less curious, right? And I've been in a lot of weird Christian cultures. We're in the subculture of homeschooling, which is, I mean, you meet characters, let me tell you. And there's all sorts of reasons for why people homeschool. I've been in the Christian school culture, but it's weird in that often in these sub-Christian cultures, Jesus somehow makes us less curious, not more. More closed off to culture than not. Sort of our world gets small, which is odd once you know this, right? Through him, everything that has been made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. There's more freedom in the Christian worldview to pursue all these things, to be interested in all sorts of things, right? Linguistics, literature, philosophy, religion, the study of other religions, biblical studies, theology, human and natural sciences. But, this is key, a Christian also knows that every one of those pursuits, you're going to find things that are flawed. You're going to find human agendas. You're going to find lots of different things, right? Because nothing is as it once was, and nothing is as it will be. And so as our interest grows, as our curiosity grows, as our pursuit of all these different areas that should open up for us as Christians, Christians aren't surprised when we find human rebellion in these areas, where we find human prejudice, you know, where we find human misunderstandings, human blind spots, human agendas, right? And that's in every area, including the sciences, you're going to find that. Narratives, things like that. Doesn't mean we shouldn't pursue those things. We're not surprised, though, that there are human failures within these areas. Nevertheless, the one trait that should guide our interaction with culture should be what? Paul says this in Corinthians, be on your guard, stand firm, it's all good, in the faith, be courageous, be strong. How are we to engage? Do everything. In what posture? Love. I think this is key. Our interaction with culture shouldn't be any different, no exception to the rule. First, when I say that our posture towards the world should be rooted in love, I think one of the things that this does is it makes sure that all of our interactions with even others understands that when we're interacting with other people, they're connected. I think this is some of the things that have gotten lost in like even internet, say online sort of discussions and debates. So this is true. Any book that we read of somebody that we disagree with, any person who posts something that we disagree with, whatever it is, we have to remember that those people come from a place. They have family, they have insights, they have weaknesses, they have blind spots, they have all the things that you and I have. I think one of the things that we've lost as a culture is we think people are saying these things as silos or saying these things without the same cultural forces upon them, or as if they've been beamed down to this planet and aren't a part of a community somewhere or part of other people's lives somewhere, and I think we've lost that. But Augustine, in the 4th century, this is must reading. This was must reading. It was mandatory reading when I went into Bible college on Christian teaching. Sometimes it's translated on Christian doctrine. It was mandatory reading in seminary. I think it should be mandatory reading for anyone who desires to teach. But he gave this advice already in the 4th century concerning reading people we disagree with, interacting with people we disagree with. He says we should never interact with people as subjects or as a subject to dominate. And then he says, but we also shouldn't interact with something we disagree with as an object to be dominated by, but rather we should seek in each of these things some of the good that's going to be there, God's goodness, and we should also see in these things certain aspects of human, you know, sin and the blind spots that exist you know, interacting in a different way is often a symptom of our pride and our sin. But the golden rule that he gave of interacting with people who disagree with us, the golden rule is to read others like you would want to be read, or interact with others as we would want to be read. Here's the second posture that I want to talk about in terms of love and engaging in culture. It's not just finding the good in everything. For example, we're not to get to the end of Hitler's Mein Kampf and be like, man, I was really moved by the way that he weaved those images, by the ways in which he kind of weaved those metaphors. It's not that we shouldn't read and try to understand why people said these things, but we shouldn't get to the end only seeking the good. Be like, wow, I was really emotionally moved by the way that he worked in those metaphors. So it's not just affirming the good in everything. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from Christians, and by the way, non-Christians alike, that Christians, they need to be more loving. Often they'll say they need to be less judgmental. One interesting irony is you'll often see in our culture non-Christians using Christian principles to judge how Christians should act, which is a whole nother conversation. But the idea that Christians need to be more loving typically in our culture means Christians need to affirm everything. And they just need to agree with everything. I think this is a mistake. To assume that love always means to affirm everything and to agree with everything is a modern version of, it's a modern heresy of love. It's not real love. And here's why I chose the passage that I did. Christ loved the religious leaders. And he loved the teachers of the law. And he loved the Pharisees. And everything I'm about to say, we cannot say without understanding that he was willing to die for them. So don't take Jesus' response here and what I'm about to say as if, yeah, we just need to tell people the truth. The difference between you and me is he was willing to die for them. There was sacrificial love which made him capable of saying what he was about to say. Because he was. He loved them deeply. And yet, okay, it's interesting, Jesus will rail against them. He'll call them snakes and vipers. He even puts them on notice concerning the hardness of their hearts. In the passage that we read in Luke chapter 20, you'll notice he's very suspicious of their question. If you were just affirming the good in everybody, you wouldn't be suspicious of questions. You'd be like, oh yeah, that's a great question. Jesus doesn't say great question. In fact, he treats their question with real suspicion. And then based on their duplicity, he won't respond to them. All right, if you're not going to be straight with me, I'm not being straight with you concerning where my authority comes from. Compare and contrast the woman at the well. He deals with her real failures. He doesn't go systematically through each one of them, just pouring on the shame as he deals with her. He's also at great risk in that scene, given who she is. And, notice the contrast, he does tell her so that she's not confused concerning who he is, his identity, and where he comes from, where he gets his authority from. My point in saying all that is a posture and interaction with the world and culture for it to be, you know, loving is never a blanket affirmation. It's never a one-speed pitch, not to use a baseball analogy, but let me use a baseball analogy. Jesus sometimes throws it right down the middle. Sometimes he changes it up. Sometimes he'll just beam the person to get him off the plate. But he never just throws the same pitch. And that's how he deals with different people. It's never just biting, you know, critique. It's never just satire. And I think of the greats who did it, and they did it with pen, but I think of the greats, like, who interacted with culture. I think of the C.S. Lewis's who, you know, he often clothed his images as art, you know, in arguments. You know, G.K. Chesterton would just give people buffets of onions. He never gave you, it's just all paradox all the time. And then you have Tim Keller, who was more erudite. He had his New Yorker in one hand, his Bible in the other, and he knew in Manhattan that those folks didn't leave their faith. They didn't leave religion. They just sort of merged it. They entered into putting their trust in things, and he just started pulling on those cultural strings that people ultimately put their faith and their trust in, their success, their careers, all those things that they'd be willing to die for. There's disagreement on whether or not he would be as effective today because there's been a vibe shift, but we can't go back and replay what that would be like today if he were to start over. I think he would still be very effective. My point is they all did it so different. Some people use polarization tactics. Some people use humor. Some people use winsomeness. Some people are more insistent. Some people, you know, carry this strong conviction, but they interact with a tremendous amount of compassion. But neither of them were afraid of conflict. None of them were. Love doesn't avoid real conflict. Love doesn't avoid hard conversations or real disagreement. It actually goes wherever love leads. And sometimes love leads us right into the jaws of really difficult conversations, really hard conversations. Love's never been afraid of that. If we're, in this room, intellectually honest, relationally honest, the people that we love the most are the ones that we're willing to say hard things to. It's always been the case. And maybe it's because strangers aren't worth our time. We're not really that interested in discipling people, where we just sort of nod our head and, you know, are more agreeable and wait for the conversation to be over. If you really actually love those you are engaging with, you're willing to have difficult conversations. I'm in the process of warming up my college football podcast because it's about that time of year, just to see what's going on. And I was listening to one coach and a graduate student in his fifth year. And the coach was asked, what makes this leader different this year than all the years prior? He's finally willing to confront his teammates. But there's love in that huddle, so he can. When we love deeply, we're willing to have the hard conversations, even disagreeable ones. Third, our interactions, if they are to be loving in culture, are going to mean real understanding, where we empty ourselves out. And I don't mean emptying ourselves of our worldview, emptying ourselves of what we understand the gospel to be, emptying ourselves of our ethics, or blindly affirming everything. But in order to be hospitable to culture, we are going to have to try to understand deeply why people hold to what they hold and live the way they do. The real test for that, by the way, of seriously entering into other people's shoes and emptying ourselves, is can you speak, can you explain better than other people can why they hold to what they hold in a way that they'd be proud of? Like, you really get it. You said that better than me. This is very different than the stuff you see online and talking heads and punditry, right? I'm not talking ventriloquism. Ventriloquism is, you know, you just sort of repeat the talking points that other have better than they can. But you're not seeking, you come away from that no more wiser, but here's more importantly, you come away from those interactions no more connected. Because the goal in that's not connection, the goal in that is winning and dominance. Christian interaction with the world and those who disagree with us, for it to be an act of love, has to be understood as the pursuit of real relationship, real connection, rather than power, rather than winning an argument or dominance, seeking understanding rather than asserting oneself. It doesn't assume that there is a hidden motive behind the reasons why they disagree with you. It doesn't assume that the reason they're wrong is because of something in their childhood, or the reason that they're wrong is because, you know, they grew up this way, or the reason that they're wrong is because, well, of socioeconomic status, or the reason that they're wrong is because they didn't go to the same school that I did, or because of some prejudice. Also, a Christian loving interaction with culture doesn't assume that this group over here, what they affirm and their attitude is always right, and this group over here, their attitude and the way that they say their talking points are always, you know, right or always to be condemned. And yet at the same time, and this is key, a Christian is not naive that there's something like neutrality. Neutrality doesn't exist. Nobody is operating from a place of neutrality. But lastly, and I think most importantly, interacting with the world from a posture of love must be rooted in the understanding that we are already loved. And we are already being loved. And this is key, because we never have to justify ourselves. If you listen to Christians and how we often interact with the world, it's as if we're trying to justify. We're already justified. We're already made right. And the goal isn't to be right. We've already been made right in Christ. Or how about this? If you believe in our interaction with the world that our identity is at stake, then I highly recommend you return to the beginning. That is the good news. Or if you think that we have to defend Jesus, you've already lost. Or even defend this word. It's not that we can't give reason for our faith, we're called to do that. But if our job is to justify, if our job is to win the argument or to win some kind of culture war or to defend Jesus, we're already in a losing spot. Because our identity in Christ is never on the table as we, or at stake, as we engage our world, our culture. And this is what I mean when I say the Christian worldview can be unusually open as it engages the world. First and foremost, because our identity as we do so is not at stake. Would you please pray with me? Our Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, God, you spoke everything into being, and you knit each and every soul with sacred intention, and we bless your name. God, we don't come as conquerors of culture. We don't come as warriors of culture, but as fellow travelers, fellow pilgrims, hungry for beauty, aching for justice, weary from all the noise. God, in our culture, we see both. We see mess and meaning, echoes of you. We see it in the art of a poet. We see it in the cry of a protester. We see it in the laughter around a table, the grief on the streets. There you already are, weeping and laughing and loving still. So God, give us eyes to see, give us ears to hear, not just where the world is wrong or culture is wrong, but where it longs for you, yearns for you. Not just where it resists your word, but where it even reflects it in spite of itself. So God, make us bold, but give us gentleness. Convicted without arrogance, anchored by grace, humbled by mercy and your mystery. And God, we're sorry. We're sorry for every time that we've mistaken power for faithfulness, or certainty for wisdom, and separation for holiness. God, teach us to listen more than we speak, to linger where the margins exist and where they are, to trade fear for curiosity, to trade in control for communion, fellowship, and connection. And God, remind us, as you reminded the prophets, as you reminded the doubters and the misfits, that your world isn't built by winning arguments or dominance or getting it right, but by washing feet and sacrificial love. O Christ, who dwelt among us, not above, who ate with those at the margins, who upset the proud and the religious and the pious, form us more and more into your image, so that when we engage the world, as you've called us, we don't bring you where you are not, but learn to meet you where you already are. In the name of the one who is making all things new, all of God's people,